For today, we have something different that we hope you'll enjoy. Last Sunday, I hosted a live national call-in show called America, Are We Ready? Democracy and the Year Ahead. It looked away from the impeachment news of the day and instead at the place of impeachment in our democracy. We had two great guests. Here it is. Hope you enjoy. This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's the day after Thanksgiving, Friday, November 29th. This will be different from the impeachment coverage in the news. We will look away from the developments of the day and ask, what role should impeachment play in a democracy? When would removing an elected president protect our democratic foundation? And when would impeachment threaten or weaken it? Our guests will be two impeachment historians, Mary Frances Berry from the University of Pennsylvania, former chair of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, and Jeffrey Engel from SMU, co-author of Impeachment and American History. Dr. Berry first. She is also author of the book that came out last year, History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. Dr. Berry, so nice to speak to you again. Welcome to America, Are We Ready?
All right. I think I'm ready.
I think you're ready, too. Dr. Berry, you've said the framers of the Constitution saw impeachment as a matter of law, but also as a political matter. What's your understanding of how they saw that balance in terms of what would make the best democracy?
Well, the impeachment was sort of a safety valve. The overriding principle was that officials should be elected. The president should be elected. I mean, that's preferable being a democracy. But they wanted to make sure that there was a remedy if, in fact, a president did the things that are in Article 2, like, in fact, and in Article 1, if the president overstepped the bounds of his authority and engaged in what they called high crimes and other misdemeanors and so on, then there would be some way to get rid of the person. But they saw it as an extraordinary remedy, not a day-to-day remedy, and that you could argue, and they probably would have agreed, that if we saw democracy at risk, and we could clearly show that that was the case, democracy meant to them a representative government. If we saw it at risk by the official who was in office, then we should do something, and impeachment was a remedy before the next election took place.
You've said the impeachment of Andrew Johnson in 1868 is the most like Donald Trump's. Why, in terms of democracy, that one?
Well, because Andrew Johnson was accused of, there were a number of things in the articles of impeachment. But in the main, the Republicans in Congress were opposed to him being opposed to their policies, and they were sick and tired of his behavior as a person, and also his opposition to things like the policy on race toward the freedmen who had been freed as a result of the war, and his opposition to almost everything they tried to do. So they set a trap for him. They passed a law which prohibited him from getting rid of the Secretary of War who was in office. And then when he violated it and got rid of the person, the trap closed. And that was sort of the smoking gun, as it were. He had violated an act of Congress. The Tenure of Office Act that they were talking about was probably illegal anyway, because the president has a right to get rid of officials.
We know that the Senate advises and consents on nominations and appointments.
Right.
This would be to let somebody go.
Right.
That would certainly hobble Donald Trump. But what was the... Well, you describe this as a law passed specifically to entrap Andrew Johnson so they could impeach him for reasons that were really other than that they really wanted to impeach him for. That doesn't sound very democratic.
Well, they thought it was democratic to engage in the policies that they were trying to implement on the question of race and the future of the freed people and the future of the country at the end of the Civil War and during Reconstruction. They saw that as a valid democratic goal. Actually, the reason why Johnson ended up not getting impeached, although he was a purely obnoxious personality, and one could see a lot of reasons for impeaching him if you wanted to just get rid of him, was because it was pointed out that if he really left office, the guy who would replace him, who would come into office, since there was no vice president, was somebody who was obnoxious to most of the radicals, too. So it didn't work out, and it was political in the end. That's the whole point of it. It was a political thing that they did to try to get rid of him, and they set a nice trap, but it didn't work.
So let me play you a clip of Attorney General William Barr from just 10 days ago, in which he sees the number of investigations against Donald Trump in what might be similar terms.
I don't deny that Congress has some implied authority to conduct oversight as an incident to its legislative power. But the sheer volume of what we see today, the pursuit of scores of parallel investigations through an avalanche of subpoenas, is plainly designed to incapacitate the executive branch, and indeed is touted as such.
So, Dr. Berry, that's why Barr, who's a big advocate of presidential power, he has been for a long time, not just of Donald Trump, presidential power versus the executive branch, legislative branch, he thinks the president should be immune from most investigations so he can't get harassed, as Barr sees it, out of doing his real job. How do you see that balance, either for democracy in general or in this case?
I see it from the perspective as a historian, and also because I happen to have been a political official in both the Carter administration and the Clinton administration. So I've seen it from the inside and the outside. So it is true that Congress has oversight power and they're supposed to exercise it, but the Congress can, if it wants to, try to tie down a president to keep him from implementing things that the Congress doesn't want done if they're of a different party, just by the frequency and the number of investigations. Now, with Trump, there's a lot to investigate. There was a lot to investigate with Andrew Johnson. But it is indeed true that there can be, that's a good way. In fact, if you're in opposition and you're part of the resistance, that's a good way to keep the president from doing many things. The other side of it, though, is that, and I saw this with Bill Clinton and with Carter, who was not, of course, being impeached, but I saw what the effect of congressional inquiries and stuff can be. And with Clinton, the impeachment, it can get the president mostly distracted by the impeachment process, and therefore not able to put his full time and attention, to the extent that he has any attention, on the issues that come up of the day. And there are issues, if you're president, whoever it is, that, you know, every minute there's something. So if you pile on enough of them, then you can sort of keep him from doing anything, but you can also make it impossible for him to make good decisions, even if he knew how, about things that happen on a daily basis.
Let's take a phone call. Tanya in Fort Worth.
Yes.
You're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Tanya.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have a question or a comment?
Yes, sir, I do. What I'd like them to talk about is the role of Congress. Even if a president is popular with the public, if he's doing things that are truly unethical and or against our Constitution, illegal, where should Congress fall? And should it be a partisan process at all? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you so much. Dr. Berry?
Well, Well, if a president is doing something that becomes a high crime, other misdemeanor, or an abuse of office, and it can be proven, then it doesn't matter that the president was elected. Congress should go about impeaching the person, but they should do it as quickly as possible so as not to interfere with what I was talking about earlier, the day-to-day business of an executive trying to run the country. If you're going to impeach somebody and you're going to kick them out of office, go ahead and do it and then let the next guy come in, but to drag it out. But you have to be careful to make sure that it does rise to that level rather than characterizing something that does not. Many people have said that there are things that presidents do that they would impeach them for, but that the Congress doesn't seem to want to impeach them for that. They're impeaching them for something else. But if it is if it rises to high crimes and other misdemeanors, then or abuse of office, then in fact Congress should go right ahead with what it's doing.
I want to play another clip of Attorney General Barr from that speech the other day and get your reaction to this.
The fact of the matter is that in waging a scorched earth, no holds barred war of resistance against this administration, it is the left that is engaged in the systematic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law.
So Barr sees the word resistance as representing something not so compatible with democracy that he thinks is taking place right now. Your book is called History Teaches Us to Resist. So how do you see the word or the act differently from the Attorney General?
Well, part in a democracy, part of what you're able to do is to use pressure and civil disobedience and legal matters, anything, you're not using violence, but to protest and to try to get the government to change its policies. We see that now with the people who are interested in the climate change issue, for example. In a democracy, resistance is actually part of democracy. I often say that protest is an essential ingredient of politics. You vote, you put people in office, and then you put pressure on them to get them to pay attention to your issues.
I guess the Attorney General sees resistance as something more militant or something than protest.
Well, you sit in if you, you know, need to sit in. You go to jail if you need to. You, as in terms of the Congress, if it's part of the resistance, as I think the House of Representatives is part of the resistance, if the guy does something that is violates the Constitution, or you think it does and is an abuse of power, then you move to impeach the person. In that case, impeachment becomes part of the resistance.
Let's take another call. Gretchen in Minneapolis. Hi, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Gretchen.
Hi. I'm interested in more about high crimes and misdemeanors and what that meant with our founding fathers and what it means today or how what we think it means today. With a, President Trump's style of government has been referred to as transactional. And my understanding was that the framers of our Constitution were very, very concerned about embroiling the president with other heads of state because democracy wasn't like the default position. It was kind of new. And the way government happened often was with heads of state working deals behind, you know, closed doors. So I'm wondering if and that kind of sounds like what is happening now.
Well, first of all, presidents have always made deals with other heads of state behind closed doors in any administration. I mean, there are some things that they don't talk about in public. It's been going on from the beginning of the Republic. And that would not be considered a high crime or other misdemeanor unless what they were making the deal about was something that was an abuse of power. If it's a deal I like, I think it was great. If it's a deal I don't like, I would think it was awful. in any case, depending on what the policy is, because presidents, by the way, make policy. They part of their electoral mandate is to make and change policy. Now, high crimes and other misdemeanors. Clearly understood, it seems to me, by them, the people who wrote the Constitution, what you meant when you said those words. By high crimes, you didn't mean somebody trespassing or somebody doing something like that. You meant a matter of state, of high purpose, and that this would be something that, if the president engaged in it, it would be illegal, and the Congress could impeach the person for that. Not just the president, but other officers could also be impeached. So I think that they had a clear understanding of what it was, but it was not that people could not talk to other heads of state or have things said to them or make deals with them.
You've pointed out that a difference between Trump's situation and the previous ones is that he's got a re-election coming up within a year. Andrew Johnson did not, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton. How do you think that should inform the balance between having Congress decide on his removal as maybe what we would call an act of representative democracy versus letting the people be his jury, a direct democracy, if that's the right term?
Well, I think that it depends on what the Congress or the House, which is engaged in the impeachment, thinks the president is likely to do that would harm the republic between now and the election. If they think the president is going to do something going forward that in fact will destroy democracy or undermine democracy writ large, and that the country just can't stand waiting till the election, then they should go ahead and try to get the Senate to agree with them to remove him from office. If they think it's just a matter of, yes, we think this is illegal, but it's a close case and we think what he did is wrong and inappropriate, whatever it is, but it doesn't mean that the democracy will be undermined before the election, then I think they would decide differently. I think Nancy Pelosi had some pause about that when she said earlier in the year that she didn't want to go forward with impeachment unless it was bipartisan and as a matter of last resort. So that's where I would come down.
By the way, before we leave Andrew Johnson completely aside, my understanding of history is that he was acquitted in the Senate by one vote for the very sad reason that many senators were for some civil rights after slavery, but not that many, not as many as the new president who would have replaced Johnson would have been for. How much is that your understanding?
Oh, yes. It was Benjamin Wade, as I mentioned earlier. He was considered to be more radical from Ohio and more of a person who would have what we would call today progressive policies on the issues of how to deal with the South and so on. And many people also considered him to be an obnoxious, overbearing personality, much as they found Johnson obnoxious for other reasons. So basically, they didn't want him to become the, and his views on economic matters were not something that they were supportive of. So it was not, you know, we don't want him. So this gave pause to some people.
A little bit away from the question of whether Andrew Johnson committed high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right. He obviously did not. Andrew Johnson, as much as I dislike his approach and hate what he did in vetoing the Freedmen's Bureau Bill and the Civil Rights Act and all of his racist sort of behavior, that violating of the Tenure of Office Act was not a high crime or other misdemeanor.
We'll switch historians in midstream here, but keep going. We thank University of Pennsylvania historian Mary Frances Berry, also author of the 2018 book, History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And with us now, Jeffrey Engel, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University and co-author of the book published last year called Impeachment, An American History. Dr. Engel, thank you for joining us.
Hi. Good to talk to you again.
You've said that the framers of the Constitution saw impeachment as a check on excessive power. What kinds of scenarios did they most have in mind?
You know, what's fascinating is that they went through a series of hypothetical scenarios during discussions at the Constitutional Convention, which sounds somewhat eerie for our own day. For example, they pose, what if a president were to somehow deceive or dissemble or lie in order to gain office? And the answer generally was, well, then, of course, they should be removed from office. What if a president were to work with a foreign power to somehow influence their office? So then the person should be removed. What if a person were to, you know, use their office to, you know, bribe people around the bribe others to do things with the power of the office, not so much taking bribes, but rather giving bribes, if you will, with the power of his office? Well, that's a person that should be removed from office. And my last one that I think is really pertinent, at least it was part of the discussion a few months ago, was what if a president were to use his or her pardon power in order to essentially, you know, get all of his co-conspirators off the hook and thereby prove his own innocence? Well, then that's a person that should be impeached. So basically, all of their concerns were about a president who would use the power of his or her office for their own personal gain and not necessarily for the good of the state.
Why treason and bribery as the only crimes that were singled out by name? Not murder, not robbery. We could go down a list. Why just those two?
You know, one of the first things we need to take a step back on when we think about the language that's used here is that much of this language is actually changed and employed by an editing crew at the very end of the Constitutional Convention. So in many ways, the language is done to be elegant as much as it is to be precise. And treason and bribery, I think, are two crimes that were very easily understood that fit the general pattern of how they perceive a president to require impeachment. You don't get impeached, they argued, for being a lousy president. You don't get impeached for what they refer to as maladministration, that's a bad administration. You don't get impeached for having bad policies. What you get impeached for is for putting yourself above the state. So putting yourself above the state in a treasonous manner, working with an enemy to undermine the state, putting yourself above the state in a bribery manner. And again, the sense that they had of bribery, the very definition that they had of bribery, is really different than we have today in the 21st century. We typically think of bribery as someone offering money to get a public official to do something. Their greater concern and their immediate sense of the word bribery was about a public official using their money from their office or the power of their office or the influence of their office to get someone else to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do. It's essentially a giving as opposed to receiving sense of bribery. And of course, high crimes and misdemeanors was basically a turn of phrase at the time. So it's almost similar to saying, you know, franks and beans or balls and strikes. It's basically a term that everyone understood at the time to mean a crime not against another person, but a crime, again, against the people.
I think we have a caller kind of to that point. Lisa in Queens, New York City. You're on America. Are we ready? Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for taking my call.
I missed you all week
during the impeachment hearings. So as I understand it, the framers put the impeachment clause in the Constitution because they were looking to avoid monarchy, which they had just gotten out of. And they didn't have to deal with, you know, Citizens United and people breaking the Emoluments Clause and partisanship and, you know, gerrymandering. And so I'm just wondering, how would that, it's hard to compare apples to oranges there. So I'm just wondering how the gentleman there would view, you know, what we're dealing with today and what the framers had in mind.
You know, it's a great question, and I think I'd like to go really big picture on you for how the framers understood the presidency in general. We always have to remember that when they framed the office of the president, they did so with one man in mind, with George Washington in mind. He actually was also the president of the Constitutional Convention. In fact, it was actually quite difficult, we know from the record, for them to discuss the office of the presidency at first because Washington was in the room and it was so obvious he was going to be the first that Benjamin Franklin had to intervene, essentially, in the conversation and say, okay, we know he's first. Let's move on and discuss this in a more abstract way, lest it be embarrassing. And the reason that they chose Washington was not because he was the smartest person in the room, not because he was the best general that they had, certainly not the best politician, but rather because he was the one who was trusted the most. He exemplified the primary attribute that founders wanted in a political leader, which is virtue, virtue in a classical sense of being willing to sacrifice their own, your own needs for the needs of the people. And you get reputation and you build up a credibility by showing how much you can put yourself below the needs of the people. So in a sense, I think what the founders would look at today is, do we have a president who is doing something that George Washington would not? That is to say, is this person doing something that shows that he values himself more than the needs of the nation as a whole? Because that was the whole point of the virtue that they saw as necessary for a political leader.
Well, Lisa brings up monarchies and that word monarchy, and we had just gotten out of a monarchy at the time of the framers. One of the main concerns of Donald Trump's critics is that he's building toward authoritarianism, right? But I imagine any articles of impeachment would be much more specific, like using foreign policy to leverage a political favor from Ukraine. So how do you see the battle we're in terms of protecting or weakening democracy as flowing from the conversation that they were actually having in the impeachment hearings this week or not?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that we of course know that this was in the aftermath, this was written in the aftermath of the American Revolution, as you point out, a fight against monarchy, a fight against, but more importantly, it's conceived by the people of the time as a fight against tyranny, that is to say, a fight against some power that was out to destroy the people's individual liberties and collective liberties, to destroy this, the body politic. Tyranny is the word that they use, and that word is really specific because they were concerned not only about the president becoming tyrannical, they were also concerned, in fact, I'd argue even more concerned, about Congress becoming tyrannical. That is to say, if a majority held sway in Congress, it could essentially override the rights of small states or the rights of individuals because majority rules at all times. And this is why they set up the system in a different way than I think people were taught in school. We were unfortunately all taught in school that the Constitution features a separation of powers. I think it would have been better if we had been taught that the Constitution represents a struggle of powers, a competition of powers, and that each of the branches of government, each of the three branches in Maine in particular, were given the authority to essentially try to get more power from the other. So the real concern that I have today, as we look, you know, really at the broad outlines of what the discussion is about President Trump, is not necessarily that he is going to create some form of tyranny. It's that the presidency has overwhelmed the other two branches, and Congress should, every person in Congress, if they followed the way the Constitution's authors desired, should be jealously guarding constitutional prerogatives for Congress. That's the only way to keep the tyranny from growing more broadly.
Let's take another call. Janice in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. You're on America, Are We Ready? Are you ready, Janice?
Yes, thank you. I'm calling in about another part of the Constitution which is related to impeachment, and it's Article 3, Section 3. And in there it says this. It says that treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses. And what I'm looking at here is we know Russia is our enemy, and they've been trying to undermine our elections and our democracy for years. And our security agencies and through the Mueller report have reported that indeed they did undermine our elections in many different ways. And so then we have somebody in the presidency who stands up in front of the world in Helsinki and says, publicly agrees with Putin that he, you know, he couldn't have done this. And then at the same time with this Zelensky thing in Ukraine, what the president attempted to do is withhold aid from our ally who to get the dirt on a political rival and give aid and comfort again to Russia. So I guess my it's a kind of a question and a statement. If impeachment protects democracy when there's possible treason, then I think that this is a case where we really need to look at this very carefully because we have somebody who is giving aid and comfort to one of our biggest enemies in the world.
You know, I think we need to remember that the entire impeachment conversation is by definition subjective. In fact, one might even say it's by definition political. And we in our day have sort of a negative taint to the word political. We think it's a nasty word. But the truth of the matter is that's what this is all about, is the interaction between people for the good of the country and the good of the people. So ultimately, the reason I say that is that if one is fully on board with the idea that Russia is your enemy and the president is doing things that help Russia, that might sound like a treasonous act. But the problem is we get back to that question of maladministration. That is to say, a president could say, quite reasonably, I think, I'm doing these things that appear to be short-term gain for Russia, but really they're in America's long-term strategic interest. And, you know, anybody who critiques that policy, because none of us have an actual crystal ball for the future, anyone who critiques that policy would have to say, well, sir, that's a bad policy. But bad policy is not actually a reason to impeach. And it's very, very subjective and very difficult. But certainly, I think President Trump has given a lot of evidence to support the questioner's hypothesis.
My producer told me that you want to crack at one of the questions that I asked Dr. Barry a little bit earlier, the one pointing up a difference between Trump's situation and previous ones, which is that he's got an election coming up within a year. And I'll ask you the same question I asked her. I think you want it. How do you think that should inform the balance between having a Congress decide on his removal, which is an act of representative democracy, and letting the people be his jury, a direct democracy, if you will?
You know, I'm going to agree in basic premise with the other historian, who was very eloquent on this as well, you know, because I think we need to remember that the Constitution doesn't give any time frame on when the people's rule really matters and when it doesn't. And so the real concern that we need to have for a president who people might think is impeachable or requires impeachment is that they're still in office. You know, all the conversation I find fascinating in the Congress, especially in the right-wing media sphere, that the real concern here is what happened in 2016. The real concern here is perhaps the corruption of Joe Biden or Hunter Biden. The real concern here is Burisma or Hillary Clinton in some way. Fine. Fair. You know, if you want to investigate that till the cows come home. Only one person is the actual president going forward. So in a sense, it's not a constitutional question if Joe Biden was corrupt. There is no evidence, of course, but it's not a constitutional question. It's a constitutional question if the president of the United States is abusing his or her office in order to find out something about one of his political enemies. And so I think what we need to remember is that, yes, it's true that the people will have their vote in November, but one of the things that was explicitly discussed at the Constitutional Convention is the notion that a president who abuses power in order to gain office will likely abuse power in order to keep office. And therefore, essentially, just because you win, this is an explicit discussion, just because you win is not justification that you are right. It essentially justifies you as being the one who is able to convince the most people to vote for you, which you may have done through nefarious means. All of which is to say, if there is an impeachable act and a president needs to be removed, they need to be removed quickly because they are still holding the power of the presidency until the day when they are kicked out of office.
Here's a caller to our podcast with a question about this impeachment in terms of the broad sweep of the history of the United States. Listen to this.
Hi, I'm Justin from Accokeek, Maryland. So there's been all these impeachments through history, you know, like four of them, I think. And they seem to be, you know, just like on a curve, they seem to be becoming more and more frequent. And I've seen graphics lately showing kind of the divisions among the political parties. And I was wondering, like, is this kind of a symptom of the extreme polarization of our governing bodies? And if so, how does that bode for the future? Like, in 50 years, is every president going to finish their term with impeachment? Or, you know, especially since Trump's kind of opened the floodgates for what is and is not capable for a president to kind of carry out. Just curious about that.
Yeah, so am I, Dr. Engel. That is such a big question, and I certainly, and I am not a historian, cannot answer it. But he's right, I guess. If you look at the big sweep of history,
sure,
the first impeachment wasn't until Andrew Johnson in 1868, and then not until Nixon. But then we've had Nixon, Clinton, and now Trump seems to be headed for it, all within 50 years, 40 years, 45 years.
You know, I think this is where we have such a small sample size that graphing something doesn't really work all that well, because the graph certainly does appear to be going up. And I would completely agree, as with everyone else with eyes and ears, with the notion that we are in a hyper-partisan moment today, one of the most partisan moments in American history. That said, I think we need to remember that each of the presidents who were either impeached, or in Nixon's case or Trump's case, under the threat of impeachment, did something wrong, did something that got people's attention. And my evidence for this is that Barack Obama was just as despised and hated by his enemies as Donald Trump is by his. President George W. Bush was hated and despised by his enemies. Bill Clinton was hated and despised by their enemies. Of those three, only one did something that actually was of their own decision that was an impeachable offense. All of which is to say, in this hyper-partisan age, I'm not worried about presidents going forward being impeached just because they're from another party, but I do think presidents need to be wary that what they do, perhaps the bar is lower for people's fury because we're in such a partisan age, but you still have to do something. President Trump would not be in this mess if he hadn't picked up the phone and called the president of Ukraine. Period. No one can dispute that. So consequently, a future president need not worry if they are doing everything right.
Let's take another phone call. And here is Charles in Hoboken, New Jersey, who's on the same point, I think, of when the people should decide as opposed to the Congress. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Thank you, of course, for this program and the great work that you do every day, Brian.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know, how is it possible that if the president undermines an election, which is what he is ostensibly trying to do by receiving the help of a foreign agent to gain an advantage in that election, how could you then possibly say that the election itself should be the mechanism by which we determine the will of the people? It doesn't make any sense. It's a loop that can never be closed, because here he is trying to solicit assistance from a foreign government in order to influence an election, which, by the way, is the only underpinning of democracy that exists. So how then can he violate democracy or our democracy and then turn around and say, allow the mechanisms of democracy to determine whether or not I'm worthy to be in office?
It's an interesting logical and rhetorical argument, but people might push back at you and say, but the people have an opportunity to do that, so why do you want to give it to the elites?
It's not about the elite. It's about the fact that already Donald Trump has sullied the next election. The fact that that Joe Biden is still the front runner for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. If he indeed becomes the nominee, then the election itself is soiled, because he already has the information that he wanted placed upon Joe Biden.
That's interesting, and I'm going to leave it there for time, but he's been smeared, Biden has, Dr. Engel and Charles is telling, and so a crime against the 2020 election has already been committed.
You know, honestly, I wouldn't disagree with that, and that was exactly what the founders were concerned about, that a president who lied and used deception to gain office the first time would most likely do it again, and in their case, again and again and again, because remember, there was no statute of limitations on, or no term limits, I should say, on how many times a president could be president in the original Constitution. And I think that this is a genuine concern that Americans should have going forward, that we appear increasingly to be in a media age where we are not actually evaluating the candidates based upon their positions or based upon their trustworthiness. We're evaluating them based upon what color shirt they're wearing, by which I mean red or blue. And that's a very dangerous situation, and that's why we need to make sure that the elections are, if at all possible, I don't see how, but if at all possible, held in as unsoiled a manner as possible, as your caller said.
We're going to play another voicemail question, and this one doesn't even come from the United States. Glad to hear we have listeners abroad. But this is going to ask us, all you Americans are saying this is such a big deal. Why is this even such a big deal? Listen to Liam calling in, and let me warn everybody that sound quality on this is not great, but I think you can make it out.
Hi, my name's Liam. I'm calling from Leinster. As you may guess from my accent, I'm not from the US. I'm from the UK, where we have a parliamentary system. Changing leaders is a relatively common thing that happens. It's not seen as overturning an election. My question is, with many senators and congresspeople who've been on the show and clips that have been taken from the show, they describe this impeachment process as the last thing they want to do, the worst thing that they could possibly have to do, how it's such a shame and so on and so forth. But America has a constitution and it's choosing not to enforce it for its leader, which just leaves me a bit confused. I understand the bipartisan nature of it, but why is it seen as such a bad thing to enforce the laws and rules of the Constitution when given the opportunity?
All right. And again, listeners, if that was a little choppy and hard to make out, the question from the UK is really interesting, Dr. Engel. We change leaders all the time. Every country with a parliamentary system does. When they lose the confidence of the majority, out they go. What is so sacrosanct about waiting 4 years?
It's in the Constitution. That is really the only sacrosanct part. It is the time delineated by the Constitution, and the President of the United States is supposed to be President from the moment he or she raises their hand until the moment the next person does for the oath of office. This, you may remember, was what was so difficult about the Merrick Garland case for the Supreme Court recently, that the Constitution did not say in any way, shape, or form that the President can fulfill his or her duties until 7 months before the election, until 6 months before the election. No, it's says until the day that they leave office. And so that is why we're not in a parliamentary system. We are following the rules of the game, if you will. And that is, I think, why each person within this, each party within this impeachment saga, congressional, presidential, ultimately judicial, each of them, I think, needs to go back to the original intent of the overarching philosophy of the Constitution, which was that they're supposed to be trying to do the best, not just for the country, but for their own institution as well, jealously guarding the politics of their institution, the powers of their institution. And in that sense, the Congress, if it believes the president has done something that makes it dangerous for him to remain in office for whatever reason, they are doing their duty to go forward with impeachment. But it should be rare. I mean, it should be the kind of thing that we all should be extraordinarily sad about, the idea that our nation is going through this. You can be the biggest despiser, if you will, about Donald Trump, and I hope that you would be able to take a moment and step back and say, this really is not great for the constitutional democracy that we live in, to have a leader being subject to a trial, period.
Nick in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Nick.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Fan of your show.
Thank you.
It's time to say, I think, to your neighbors and, you know, people who you don't normally speak with, that we really look at this, you know, from all angles. I wanted to just say that, you know, you spoke about William Barr earlier in your show,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people like him and Ranking Member Devin Nunes, you know, they claim that the impeachment process kind of incapacitates the president's ability to lead the nation. I'm curious to know, like, what you guys think of that. And my personal opinion says that, you know, I think it's a really great time for Americans to be reminded that it should incapacitate his ability to lead the nation. All of this is his fault.
Nick, thank you very much. And we've been trying to keep this away from Trump, good or bad, and on
sure.
the principles of democracy as reflected in the current impeachment debate. But let me pick up on one thing he said and honestly frame it into a different question. He referenced the polarization. How does the polarized state of the country, in your view, Dr. Engel, affect the impact that removal from office would have on the fabric of our democracy going forward?
You know, again, I'm actually not particularly worried about that facet going forward, because I think, as the caller pointed out, as you've pointed out, as I've mentioned before, the president, whoever he or she might be, has to do something that is questionable before this whole discussion can arise. I think the bigger issue that we need to worry about is something that the framers, frankly, I think didn't anticipate from the way that they set up the impeachment mechanisms. And work with me through this thought experiment, that if the president of the United States needs a two-thirds majority to be in the Senate to be convicted, what that really means is that if the president of the United States has within the Senate at least one-third of his party, of the same party, what that really does is mean that there's almost no congressional check or at least threat of impeachment against a president. The real concern here, I think, is that the founders, because they were against political parties generally, did not want this situation to happen, where we have a situation where a president can essentially do whatever they want so long as they have 33 plus one members of the Senate in their side, which is a minority. And that's, I think, a real concern of something that we didn't anticipate seeing, which is why I would just hope, I would hope and pray that every senator, when it gets to the point of a trial, as it looks like it's going to, will say, I'm going to listen with an open mind. Because if they come in before it starts and say, I'm going to vote with my party, I'm going to vote because I already know the solution, that's something that I think the founders would have found particularly dangerous.
And we have to leave it there with Jeffrey Engel, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and co-author of Impeachment, An American History. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.